Minister David Cameron said yesterday's closing of the News of the World wasn't enough. Today, he announced full criminal investigations into allegations of mobile phone hacking by journalists and possible police corruption. But he took rhetorical aim at the nation's politicians, too.
Because party leaders were so keen to win the support of newspapers, we turned a blind eye to the need to sort this issue, to get on top of the bad practices, to change the way our newspapers are regulated.
Cameron's judgment has come under fire, especially for his close ties to News Corp executives. Former News of the World editor Andrew Coulson resigned as a top aide to Cameron earlier this year and was arrested just this morning on suspicion of corruption and illegal wiretapping.
I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, with Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
Thanks to you, Illinois Public Media WILL surpassed the membership goal of $2.1 million by more than $25,000. We appreciate your support. It really makes a difference. Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. This morning, both of the hours are made up of archives, one recent and the two in the second hour, part of our 30th anniversary celebration, are not. They're from the early to mid-90s. In the first part of the program, you'll be hearing a conversation I had not too long ago with reporter Gretchen Morgenson about the financial meltdown. This was first presented on June 13th, so in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In this hour, we'll explore the origins of the financial crisis of 2008. And our guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She is a business reporter, and she writes the Fair Game column in the Sunday business section of the New York Times, where she also serves as assistant business and financial editor. She's the co-author of a book that we'll be talking about. She wrote the book along with Joshua Rosner. And the title of the book is Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's published by Times Books. And the book looks at what the authors identify as a big problem here, the fact that the financial institutions that had so much trouble and the people that are charged with regulating and overseeing them were just too close. And in a sense, when you look at how people have moved back and forth between the two sides, essentially they are the same people. And the book also concentrates particularly on the role in the financial collapse that was played by Fannie Mae and also the Federal Reserve. And Ms. Morgenson, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
And I guess it's funny, you know, in talking about this, I've said things like we're going to look back to this crisis, and I guess one has to acknowledge in the fact that this crisis, it's not really over, or at least in the sense that we're still dealing with the implications of what happened.
We absolutely are, David. I mean, unemployment, of course, over 9%, foreclosures continuing to be a problem, delinquency rates high. So, you know, we really, really are still in the thick of it. And that's why Josh Rosner and I decided that we really wanted to help explain this to people, because it continues to be a problem. It continues to harm people, hurt homes, hurt families. We really wanted to be able to give them sort of a roadmap of how this took place.
Yeah, and I think we ought to tip the hat to him, particularly because he was somebody who is now pointed out as somebody who really rather early on, before other people were, was pointing to some of the problems that we were seeing, like vastly overvalued housing and problems with these bundled bad mortgages. And so he really was one of the first people to sort of stand up and say, hey, look, we got a serious problem here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe the place to start, as I think often you do when you're talking about this, is really to go back, to go back some time, and to go back, in fact, to the mid-90s. This was when President Bill Clinton was president, and his administration decided that it would be a good thing to promote home ownership.
Yes.
And the idea was to forge this partnership between these quasi governmental agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and private industry, the bankers and lenders and so forth. The idea is we get these people to work together, we can make it possible for people to have mortgages, borrow the money, buy the homes, and achieve this hallmark of the American dream to have a home. And it seems like actually for a little while, maybe that actually worked okay.
Well, for a little while it did work. Now, the whole premise, I guess, was that home ownership rates had been stagnant. You know, coming out of the S&L crisis and the recession of the early 90s, I think that the president was worried about this sort of declining home ownership rate. So he decided to, you know, get everybody together, private sector, public sector, Fannie Mae, and really do a push for home ownership under the idea that, you know, owning your home creates stable neighborhoods, it creates good schools, you know, it's all a benefit, all to the good. But you see, what ended up happening was this was a very noble idea, but in the execution, it became really almost perverted, because what happened was, in order to increase the rates of home ownership to include first-time home buyers, minorities, immigrants, the private sector really started to create loans that were increasingly difficult to pay back, increasingly expensive to these people, and increasingly toxic, frankly. And so it really was not about home ownership. It was about digging yourself into debt with these very, very pernicious loans.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it also wasn't helped that then perhaps also by the same token, there were middle class people who started to look at their homes not just as a place to live, but also as an investment.
Absolutely.
And it became increasingly attractive offers would come for home equity loans.
Mm-hmm.
And banks would say, look, you look at the great value you have in this place. We're going to loan you some money so you can take that money and make home improvements or pay off your bills or go on vacation or do whatever you want. And after all, don't we all know that? See, the implicit thing was, after all, don't we all know that the value of real estate just is always going to keep going up? It can't possibly go down. So this is a no-risk proposition.
Excellent point to make, David, because that is where we really perverted the traditional idea of home ownership. You know, in the old days, you took out a mortgage, you looked at your banker in the eye, he or she looked at you in the eye and decided whether you were money good, gave you the loan if he thought you were, and then you paid it down over time. You had a mortgage burning party at the end of the line, and you owned the house free and clear, and you could pass it on to your children or your grandchildren. That was the best sort of forced savings account going in the United States. Well, when they created these home equity loans and these second mortgages that you could take out on your home, it really perverted that process, allowing you to use it as a piggy bank. But now that prices are falling, now that real estate has collapsed, people have bigger mortgages than the value of the asset that they have underlying them.
Yeah.
So it really perverted the idea of home ownership, which had traditionally been a huge source of savings in America.
Well, and also, I know there certainly was a point when I think people were really starting to raise questions about some of the crazy instruments that were available to make it possible for people to buy a home. There were interest-only mortgages, and there were adjustable-rate mortgages that might initially have offered a very attractive and affordable rate, but then a couple of years down the line, a new and much higher rate would come slamming in there, which got a lot of people into a lot of trouble. And then, of course, there was the problem that we've seen with people who got loans that probably should not have, and because the lenders did not thoroughly vet those people. They might have actually engaged in some fraud, and all of that all bound up together. You have to say, now, was there someone or some entity whose job it was to, in a sense, look over the shoulder of these lenders and say, either what you're doing is illegal, or what you're doing is unethical, or what you're doing is unadvisable? Was there anybody whose job it was to do that?
Absolutely. Well, we do have a regulatory structure in this country, whether it's the Federal Reserve, which oversees the major banks across the country, or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or the Office of Thrift Supervision. It is absolutely something that regulators should have been on top of and were not. Now, you know, you make a very good point about these lenders, you know, coming up with these crazy loans. Well, don't forget that a really key part of this puzzle was that most of these lenders sold off the loans to Wall Street, who then packaged them into securities to sell to investors. And so they had no real, you know, incentive to make sure that the loan would be repaid. All they cared about was making the fees on the loans. And so this, again, perverted the process, which had worked so well for so long, which was to do the due diligence that you needed as a banker on a loan to make sure that it would get repaid. That all went out the window when you could just package the loans, sell them to somebody else, and you know, wash your hands of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there it seems that there always was, or at least had been for a long time, a secondary market for mortgages.
Yes.
And that actually the idea there seems on the face of it to be a good one. The idea being that you're a bank, you lend somebody the money to buy a home, then you're holding the home. Well, you don't really want. You don't really want the house. You don't really want the mortgage. What you would like to do is to just to be able to loan out more money. So somebody else will come along and say, okay, I'll buy that mortgage from you. I'll give you some more money. You can then lend that out again, and somebody else can go and buy a house. Now, that sounds like actually on the face of it pretty good. The problem, though, is that indeed if that initial loan is any risk attached to that initial loan, you as the initial lender get to hand that off to somebody else, which in fact is what happened. Now, if you're an unscrupulous person, well, then that works to your advantage. Did somehow this the way that the secondary mortgage market was supposed to function, did that actually change somehow?
Well, it didn't. It just got much, much bigger, and you had a scenario where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who guaranteed many of these mortgages, if they were...
Well, the authorities there at Cape Canaveral say that they are preparing for the launch of the Shuttle Atlantis this morning. Apparently, they think that whatever weather problems were posed are not serious enough to scrub, even though earlier this morning they were saying they thought there would only be a 30% chance they would launch. So we're going to go to National Public Radio. They have been following the launch preparations, and we would hope that maybe in about 20 minutes we'll have the final shuttle launch. Now we'll go to National Public Radio in Washington.
And, the other programs that got men into space, Americans into space for the first time, of course the Russians were first in space, the Soviet Union, but this is really the end of an era.
It absolutely is, and I think there's a lot of emotion riding on this. I mean, think about it. 30 years this has been flying, and many people have grown up just with this as sort of been in the background. It's been sort of the American tradition, America's way of getting into space, and there's going to be a substantial gap before we send people back in and up there on our own devices. But it's a big moment for people.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris here with us in Washington. The latest word from NASA is that the weather does look pretty good right now. We're about 8.5 minutes away from the launch of the space shuttle Atlantis. When the countdown gets down to the final few seconds, we'll take you live to Cape Canaveral in Florida and bring you that coverage live. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. STS-135, the final mission of the U.S. space shuttle, is set to launch a few minutes from now. Atlantis is ready on the launch pad. There are no technical problems, and NASA says the weather is go. They're ready to launch. In a few minutes, solid fuel boosters and the big main engine will fire for the last time. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is here in the studio, and Judith Smeltzer joins us now. She's a reporter for WMFE, our member station in Orlando. Today, she's in the bleachers at Cape Canaveral with her eyes on Atlantis. And Judith, we've been talking a little bit about the history of the program. Tell us about this mission. What's STS-135 expected to accomplish?
This mission is actually going to be a resupply mission, the final time that a space shuttle is going to be able to go up and take a big load of supplies to the International Space Station. Of course, as you were talking about earlier, the Russian Soyuz capsules will be going up to the space station after the shuttle goes away, but they're very small, and they can't take the types of big loads that the shuttle can take. So that's exactly what NASA wants to do, take one more big load of supplies up to the space station, also take a big load down of things that they don't need anymore. And so that's really the big part. There's going to be a lot of unpacking and packing, and it's a lot to get done in not a very long amount of time. But NASA says even though it might be not the sexiest mission in the world, it's a very, very important one.
And Richard was describing it as a bus. Another description I've heard often is a space truck, and it's delivering general goods.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's delivering things that the space station is going to need to be able to survive for the next few years, and things that are big enough that the Soyuz can't get it up there. So that's what the shuttles have been good for. Of course, the shuttles also have been responsible for carrying up the parts of the space station itself over the years that the station has been being built. Huge, huge modules of the space station have gone up on the shuttle as well. And, you know, that's one of the things that they wanted to finish before they shut the program down, the shuttle program down, was to be sure and finish the International Space Station construction. They got that done on a recent mission, and now just one more load of supplies to go. Of course, this mission wasn't even supposed to fly. This was just going to be the rescue shuttle, and we can talk about that a little later if you want to. But NASA's glad it's going to be able to get one more load of supplies up to the station to sustain it.
Tell us a little bit about the crew for this mission.
Well, for one thing, it's a small crew. It's a smaller than usual crew. The most of the recent missions have had 6 or 7 crew members. Well, this one only has 4. The captain, the commander rather, is Chris Ferguson. Also, the pilot Doug Hurley, Sandra Magnus, and Rex Walheim. They're all veteran space flyers. And the reason that the crew is so small is because, as I was saying before, Atlantis was originally supposed to be just a rescue shuttle that was going to be able to go up and help out if Endeavour needed any help in ran into any trouble in the last mission, but they decided to go ahead and fly it up as a regular mission. The problem is there's no rescue shuttle then for Atlantis for this mission, and it's the rescue, if there needed to be one, would have to be done by Soyuz. Only a very small number of people can fit on a Soyuz capsule, so they didn't want to send too many crew members up. That's part of the reason that there's only 4 people.
3.5 minutes to launch of the space shuttle Atlantis, and Judith Smeltzer, the end of this program is going to be the end of a big economic effect there in the state of Florida.
A huge economic effect. We're talking about close to 9,000 people just here in Kennedy Space Center, contractors who've worked on the space shuttle program for their entire careers, for decades, some of them, losing their jobs. And, you know, the local business leaders have been trying to drum up private industry, bring in new companies, but even still, in the 7 years since the announcement of the end of the shuttle program, less than about 1,600 new aerospace jobs have been brought into this area, which is known as the Space Coast. So a lot of people are having to go out of state to get other jobs, if they even can get other jobs. And there's a lot of concern about what that's going to mean for the local economy here. Obviously, also, people are very sad to leave this program. People say that the space shuttle program is like a family. Over and over, everyone we speak to says that, and they say it's like leaving their family members. They consider the shuttle a family member too. They feel very up close and personal with each one of them. They say each one is a little different, and so it's going to be a big hole that's going to be left here on the Space Coast when Atlantis lands and completes its final mission.
Just a few weeks ago, NASA made the decision along with Congress as to where the space shuttles will spend their future in museums around the country in various different places. Richard Harris, these are, externally, they look exactly the same as the the missions that went up all those years ago, but these internally are quite different.
They are, absolutely. They've upgraded the electronics a lot. They've made many changes. One of the most significant may be the fact that they have sort of redesigned the entire external fuel tank, made it considerably lighter, which gave this shuttle capacity to carry a lot more material into orbit, because they can carry a lighter tank. They can they can put more stuff inside the shuttle. And so that was a huge advance when they did that. And, of course, upgrades after each of the accidents as well. But it has evolved over the years with the technology.
Judith Smeltzer, can you tell us what you can see there from the bleachers in Cape Canaveral?
I can see a flood of press and photographers heading down to, there's a pond between the press site and the launch pad, and heading down to the edge of this pond and just hoping against hope that Atlantis is going to be able to launch. Really, people came here this morning not expecting to see a launch. There was only a 30% chance of go because of the weather, and now it looks like it's going to happen. 1 minute now left to go in the countdown, and people are getting very excited here. People are starting to think, wow, we may actually see a launch here today.
They could still scrub the mission even at this literally last minute, but that would have to be something unusual, you would think, Richard?
Yes, absolutely. It looks like they could, but it's highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. As late as 6 seconds before the launch is scheduled, that's when they start to fire up the big main engine. Once you're there, you're committed to launch, but as Richard was explaining, there are any number of then alternatives should something happen, first landing back in Florida, then in Spain or south of France, or then back at Edwards Air Force Base. In the meantime, let's go now to Cape Canaveral, and this is the voice of George Diller, who will be doing the countdown from there.
All right, CMAC. Yes, CMAC. The LTC says we need to verify using a camera, and we're positioning camera 62 right now.
Okay, let us know as soon as 62 is swung over.
The clock has stopped with 31 seconds left to go.
And 31 seconds is the time when the computers on board normally take over the launch sequence. So they've hit a glitch. They've got about 4.5 minutes to see if they can sort it out right now.
4.5 minutes because there's a launch window of about 10 minutes. This is to do with celestial mechanics and hooking up with the International Space Station. And, well, it's a 10-minute window. They wanted to launch right in the middle of that window, so that gives them about 5 minutes to figure this out.
That's right, so...
Any explanation that you've heard there, Wendy? Judith Smeltzer?
Yeah, we heard that there was some kind of a sequencer failure, but now we're not quite exactly sure what that is. So we're waiting to hear a little bit more from NASA. They're trying to figure out exactly what's going on with the technical situation.
Let's leave the feed up and see if we can glean any information from the conversation.
Very good. And TLS?
And they're now talking about proceeding, but they're doing a check down of everybody to make sure that everyone else is cool with this idea. So
I think the last thing we heard was, I think it can work. So we'll have to see whether
it can work.
All right, guidance.
And the voice that you're hearing with a little bit more...
Just a reminder for folks, our locked in back hold time is 3 minutes and 16 seconds.
3 minutes and 16 seconds is left in the launch window. Is that what they're saying there, Richard?
I do believe that.
TLS on 212, we're ready to go. All right, very good. And launch director, with that cleanup, we're going to go ahead and proceed.
Yes, sir. Please do.
All right. And all personnel, we are going to pick up the clock here momentarily. And TLS, you can resume the clock on your mark.
I copy that. Countdown clock will resume on my mark. 3, 2, 1, mark.
He might have...
For auto sequence start.
Handoff to Atlantis' computers has occurred. Solid rocket booster nozzle steering check in work.
20.
Firing chain is armed.
15.
Go for main engine start. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1. 0 and liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle. America will continue the dream.
Control room, Houston.
Roger, roll, Atlantis.
Houston now controlling the flight of Atlantis. The space shuttle spreads its wings one final time for the start of a sentimental journey into history.
And that's the voice of Rob Navius there in Houston, who will be the commentator for the remainder of this flight as the Johnson Space Center takes over from Cape Canaveral. The booster has rolled over on its back in that, well, now familiar motion as it roars into space and burns through the cloud cover on its way. Let's go down to Judith Smeltzer. Can you tell us what you see there in Cape Canaveral?
She probably can't hear us, actually.
That's possible.
Did you say something, Neil? Yes, no, I can't hear you at all.
Can you tell us what you see?
I hope you can hear the cheering around me as well. People here are very excited. It was a beautiful sight. It lifted off. There was the trail of fire underneath. We saw it for probably about, 30, 45 seconds before it disappeared into the clouds. Amazingly, despite the threat of bad weather, I think we could see it for longer than we could see Endeavour's launch on the previous mission when it was also a cloudy day. But the chances of launch were a lot better that day than they were this day. I tell you what, people here are very excited. No one expected this to happen today, and it's almost as though the heavens parted to let this final shuttle go off as planned.
Richard Harris, they're monitoring this flight through any number of sources, including TV cameras on the booster itself.
Absolutely, and it's already heading its way up the coast of North America. It will be it's 24 miles downrange, according to Rob Navius here. So it's moving fast, and it'll just keep picking up speed. It's got about 2 minutes of those booster rockets to really get it going at a good clip, and then the booster rockets will fall away, and the three main engines will then carry it along for the next 6.5 minutes.
And there's the separation. The booster rockets are falling away from the space shuttle Atlantis, and they will plummet back to the Atlantic Ocean and be recovered. I suppose they will not be reused. There was a time when they were refilled and reused.
The booster rockets, absolutely. They were actually hoping to make many parts of the shuttle reusable, including the external fuel tank. But in the course of the design, they realized that it was actually didn't make sense that they would just drop that and let it burn up in the atmosphere. But they do. Yep, the booster rockets were the reusable component.
Judith Smeltzer, this is one last shot in the arm for the economy of the Space Coast, as hundreds of thousands of people are down there to observe this event.
The estimate was as high as 1 million people could have been here today. And, NASA was even talking about if it had to cancel today, it might wait till Sunday to go and try again because of the traffic jams. I mean, my engineer getting here, who's sitting next to me right now, it took him 3 hours starting at 5 o'clock in the morning to get out here from Orlando. This is a bucket list item. People have basically realized, okay, we may have taken the shuttle for granted for the past 20, 30 years, but this is it. And if I ever want to see this thing go off, I have to come to Florida now. Yeah, all the hotels around this area have been booked. All the restaurants have gotten, like you said, a huge shot in the arm. And, you know, that also brings up the other side of the coin. I talked about the 9,000 people who were going to be being laid off from jobs directly at the Space Center here, but there's a multiplier effect. You know, the economic development officials here estimate another 11,000 jobs could be lost in this area because of a ripple effect, a spillover from the loss of business and the dip in the economy. So while this is certainly a very exciting day and we don't want to do anything to take away from that, everybody here knows that there's got to be going to be some serious soul-searching and problems going on from now on.
Richard Harris, of course, the main impact will be felt there in Florida, but the space shuttle program was not just in Florida.
Absolutely. In fact, it was one of the secrets of its success was that politically they were able to spread it around. Mission Control is, of course, in Houston or outside of Houston, and the components were built all over the country, and so Congress people from all over the country thought the space program was a wonderful thing, and it was one reason why it had so much legs. Even when the public sort of turned away from it as it became pretty routine, it still had very strong support on Capitol Hill.
And this has created any number of aerospace companies, not just NASA, but companies that contributed bits of this program to NASA. And, well, they're going to try to stay in business doing other things.
Indeed. And, in fact, the next step in human exploration will probably be some of these commercial programs taking off and either actually transporting people to the space station or even doing space tourism activities. So, basically, over this period of time, the hope has been to hand this off and make it a profitable private enterprise.
And I wanted to go back to Judith Smeltzer. Is there any hope there amongst the people who may be losing their jobs that some other parts, private enterprise, may pick up where NASA left off?
Well, that is the hope here right now. I mean, there's companies like SpaceX that are bidding to do the commercial crew and cargo flights that NASA wants to do now. I mean, the idea is that NASA wants to help commercial companies take cargo up to the International Space Station starting here in the next 2 or 3 years, and eventually to take astronauts up there as well. That's going to be a lot farther into the future. But certainly, Kennedy Space Center is doing everything it can to try to position itself to take advantage of that and to make sure that, you know, if these commercial companies do these missions, that they still launch from Kennedy Space Center. I mean, remember, there are other spaceports now. There are spaceports in New Mexico and Virginia, and there's some competition here that Kennedy Space Center didn't used to have. So, but certainly a lot of these folks that are being laid off from the shuttle program are hoping to pick up work in the private sector. And, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't think about is that actually private aerospace firms and contractors are involved in the shuttle program. I mean, all those folks that are going to be losing their jobs, those 9,000 people, they're contract workers. They work for United Space Alliance, which is the main shuttle contractor with NASA. So it's not like the idea of private space is any big new thing here at NASA. It's just that they're not going to be supporting a government human spaceflight program, at least not right now.
And Richard Harris, we're talking, of course, about the American space program and going back all the way to the first launches back in the 1960s, and of course the landing on the moon and the successor, the space bus, as you described it, the shuttle program that's been so much a part of our lives, the fabric of our lives all these years. But there is, of course, we've mentioned it, the Russian space program, Soyuz. There are French rockets that go into space, Ariane from South America.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a Japanese cargo ship that takes cargo up to the International Space Station that has a strong Japanese component. There's also a European rocket that will take materials also up regularly to the space station. So, and the Russians will continue to bring people up there. So the space station itself will move along with the supports for right now. And as Judith mentioned, you know, maybe eventually some U.S. firms will get involved in ferrying stuff up as well. So, yeah, and let's not forget the Chinese, because the Chinese, as we sought space as a matter of national prestige, the Chinese are doing the same thing, and they have an aggressive manned space program. They're even talking about sending Chinese astronauts to the moon.
And we should not forget one aspect of this space program, the shuttle program, the International Space Station. This has helped, going back, I guess, to that first handshake in space between Soviet cosmonauts and American astronauts. This has been an aspect of international relations that should not be overlooked.
It absolutely has. The hope was that basically it would cement relationships. Sometimes it actually created some tension, particularly it did lead to some discussions as well about adequate resources and so on, but basically things have worked well. And I should note that what we've just heard on the NASA feed is that the engines have fired and done everything they were supposed to do, and they're dropping off the external tank momentarily. And so this mission is well on its way, and the launch appears to be a complete success.
Judith Smeltzer, thank you very much for your help down there in Cape Canaveral. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be with you today.
Judith Smeltzer, a reporter at member station WMFE in Orlando, joined us today from the bleachers in Cape Canaveral, where she watched the launch of the space shuttle Atlantis, which is now on its way to the International Space Station on the final mission for the U.S. Space Shuttle program. We'll follow it into orbit and talk about the future of NASA when we return. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage from NPR News.
Support for Focus comes from Body Workers.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Space Shuttle Atlantis is now in low Earth orbit, headed for the International Space Station with a payload of supplies and spare parts. It's a 12-day mission with Captain Christopher Ferguson, pilot Douglas Hurley, and mission specialist Sandra Magnus and Rex Wolheim aboard. Return is set for July 20th, which will mark the end of STS-135 and the end of NASA's shuttle program. 30 years ago, the orbiter Columbia returned to Earth to conclude STS-1. The landing was at Rogers Dry Lake Bed at Edwards Air Force Base in California. I was there, as my colleague Ira Flato and retired Brigadier General Chuck Yeager, the famous test pilot, described the last minute of the flight.
Here she comes. Here she comes.
Coming down. He's starting to level off his flare now. He's flattening out. He will get ready to slap down the gear any minute now. It's not down yet.
Doing a flat.
They're flaring at about 220. There comes the landing gear. Landing gear's down. His chase plane is on the right wing.
40.
Looking him over. Called off the altitude.
20.
That thing. He's in the mirage now. It looks like he's as big as a barn.
4.
Oh, he's flaring.
3. 2. 1.
There's the first touchdown. A beautiful touchdown.
Beautiful.
Got the nose up. Everybody is so enthused. God, that's fabulous.
Huge wake
John
up
keeping the nose up there. The nose is coming down very slowly.
Touchdown.
Everything looks beautiful on that big shuttle airplane.
The shuttle has landed on the Rogers Dry Lake Bed in Edwards Air Force Base, California.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is with us here in studio in Washington. We're joined now by Talk of the Nation Science Friday's host, Ira Flato, who happens to be in San Antonio today for a special broadcast of his program. And Ira, I remember standing and hearing the twin sonic booms the first time we heard those from the space shuttle as it came in for that landing, and we were there that day.
Who can forget that, Neil? Yeah, that was quite exciting.
And you were, of course, in Cape Canaveral for the launch and then flew out to join us there in California for the landing. All those years ago, did the space shuttle, do you think, live up to its expectations?
I think that most historians would say it did not. The main expectations of the shuttle would it would become sort of a family vehicle. You would not have to be a specialized astronaut. You would not have to be a military person. All the astronauts have been military people. We could have a teacher in space. We could have a journalist in space. We could turn these things around within a few weeks. We could have dozens of launches of the shuttle each year. None of that really panned out.
And there should not be, however, recognition of some of the great accomplishments. Richard Harris was talking earlier about the launch not just of the Hubble Space Telescope, but going up to fix the Hubble Space Telescope, and, of course, the creation of the International Space Station.
Yes, those are great accomplishments, and I agree with Richard. I heard him say this before. The Hubble is probably the shining moment of the whole life of the shuttle, but once again, we must not forget that the shuttle follows a history of American accomplishment in space, in that we do it and then we decide, what do we do now? I mean, we went to the moon and we canceled the last three moon missions out of lack of interest and money from the Vietnam War draining off some of the budget, and we didn't know what to do next. We now have the end of the shuttle missions, and we're trying to say, at least governmental-wise, if not for private industry, where do we go from here? And so it's sort of history repeating itself a bit.
Well, at least at the end of the moon missions, there was a solid idea of where to go next, and it was the shuttle program. And at this point, Ira, there doesn't seem to be much of a solid idea of what to do next.
Yes, and even the shuttle program was sort of created with a mission that was not going to leave Earth. I mean, people who were excited about going back to the moon or going to Mars, that was not what the shuttle was created for. In fact, the military was very interested in the shuttle because it was a big truck, but they then realized that after the disasters and the fact that the shuttle was not 100% reliable, even the military gave up on using the shuttle as its heavy lifting vehicle. So there was another promise that did not pan out.
Richard Harris, of course, we've been talking about the civilian side. The military side of space continues. There are all kinds of satellites and indeed reports of drone orbiters that have been used by the military.
Absolutely. And it turns out that it's if you get tied up with the delays and the sorts of things that you happen to have to worry about by adding a human being in the equation, it turns out to be a lot easier to automate things and to send things up by rockets and have these satellites operate on their own without human intervention. There were a handful, more than half a dozen military flights that we don't know exactly what was going on with them, but presumably it was more than just simply launching satellites. It was doing other things up there. So, but in the end, the military decided that it's cheaper just to launch something new than try to repair something that's up there.
And also to NASA's credit, some of NASA's greatest successes have not been in near Earth orbit. They have been in going to planets like Mars and the Pathfinders and the landers and the other space probes that are out there that are still sending back terrific photos. And we should not lose sight of that fact either.
And that, however, is a so-called robotic exploration of space. And everybody argues it's much more cost-effective. We can find out much the same kind of things. Richard Harris, though, it does not have the same romance as sending a man to the moon.
It does not. And you, when you talk about you run into people who say, you know, our destiny is in the stars and so on. And maybe someday that's true, but it's the expense, the difficulty, every step. It's such a big step from getting here to Mars or whatever. It's just enormous in terms of expense and technology and so on. So, but it is true that is something that draws people in. At the same time, let's not forget when NASA was talking about shutting down the Hubble Space Telescope, there was a huge public outcry, because people fell in love with this instrument and all of the views we've gotten from the outer planets, from the Voyager spacecrafts and so on. We have come to really appreciate so many of the robotic things that NASA has done. And let's not forget that they also watch the Earth itself, and that is of tremendous importance to us to understand our climate. And they have a lot of missions to study ice on Earth and so on. So NASA is also some of their instruments are focused downward, and that helps us tremendously.
Ira, the space dream, if you will, well, that predates NASA. It goes back to the earliest start of this century and the idea of launching rockets and all of the pioneers. But there was a compelling reason to get the United States into space the first time, the space race with the right. Soviet Union. There was a compelling reason to send men to the moon and win, a gigantic propaganda triumph as well as an enormous technological proving point. The space shuttle program really followed through on inertia after that. But is there a compelling reason for what's next?
You're absolutely right. The compelling reason to go to the moon was a political reason to beat the Soviets at that time. We have to decide for ourselves what is in our national interest. Is it not in our national interest if we want to go back to Mars, or return to the moon? Is that not enough of a compelling interest in itself? We spend a lot of money now on projects, and we talk about how expensive it is to go to Mars, for example. But if you looked at the total cost of going to Mars compared to other large expensive things that we might be necessarily doing, like being in Afghanistan and Iraq at the same time, the price of the space mission, going all the way back to the original Apollo, are not very expensive in comparison. They may be expensive in real dollars, but in comparison to the total gross domestic product of the country, it's not actually quite that expensive.
It seems to be, at least here in Washington, difficult to envision this Congress or any Congress in the near future dedicating that kind of money to a program like that without some compelling reason, though.
Exactly. And, you know, and I'm looking at the excitement that everybody had today about this last mission, and rightfully so. And it's nostalgic. And tomorrow we may wake up like, you know, the day after the night before and have to go on with our lives without the shuttle. If there had been this kind of excitement for the last 120 or 130 missions about the shuttle, people might have been more excited and said, hey, we shouldn't stop these manned missions. We belong with the Chinese or the Indians or the Japanese, who have said they are going to the moon. What kind of national policy do they? What reason do they have? What compelling reason do they have to go explore the moon, except that the moon is there, or perhaps Mars is there? They're going, And we're not. Let's not forget that in the history of exploration of the world, it wasn't necessarily the first people who got to the New World. You know, America Vespucci or the Norwegians or any of the people who got here first, they did not colonize the place. They may have been the first ones to get there, but they may not have developed it. We may go down in history as the first people to have gotten to the moon, but never have gotten back there. And it would be, I think, you know, an unfortunate reason just because we don't have a compelling political reason not to go.
There is another part of the space dream, and this goes back to science fiction writers like Robert Heinlein, who had this idea that indeed it would not be nations that sent people into space and colonies, established colonies on asteroids and planets, but companies and private enterprise that would do it. We talked to some degree with Judith Smeltzer about some of the companies that are involved in this. And Ira, I know you follow this closely.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can make the case. Let's take the moon, because it's a lot cheaper to get to the moon instead of Mars. And I was once asked by the National Science Board many decades ago about some public, what kind of public interest wonderful new project would you create? And I said, well, you know, the far side of the moon, scientists have been saying for years, is a great place to put a radio telescope. It always points away from the Earth. We have cell phones. We have all kinds of radio interference on this side. Why not build, you know, a radio telescope on the far side of the moon? And you could have the National Science Foundation involved because they build these radio telescopes. But you could make it a joint project, and maybe you can commercialize that mission, and maybe you could sell the rights to the people who are going to have to live and take care of that to commercial network or cable television or now the internet, and so you could watch people working on the moon and then spread out the cost of this. So it could actually become a joint government and private industry venture, and maybe you could budget it that way and work out that way. And I still believe there might be something to this idea.
I think if you worked on the reality TV show aspect of it, Ira, you might have something.
Yeah, well, you know, how are you going to vote somebody off the moon? That's the question you have to come up with.
What specific projects, Richard Harris, is NASA talking about? I know that there are plans for new space vehicles.
There are, and that's somewhat in a state of flux, but they're talking about a vehicle that would be built by commercial enterprise, perhaps, that would get human beings back to the space station without having to rely on the tried and true Soyuz capsules that the Russians use. But actually, NASA's exploration plans have been moving forward pretty well in returning to Mars and so on. I might add that this week in Congress, though, there's a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope that is behind time and well over budget, but it is supposed to be, you know, a more fantastic telescope than the Hubble Space Telescope. Even congressional committee is talking about killing it, as a matter of fact. So
after billions have been spent,
absolutely. So we don't know how that's going to play out through Congress, but it is certainly causing some alarm among astronomers. The idea that this is called the James Webb Telescope, and it was going to be launched a million miles from the Earth in a place like, as Ira was describing, the far side of the moon, where you're basically out of harm's way and you can observe neatly and basically have nice clear sky views all the time. But its fate is up in the air right now.
Well, to some degree, NASA's own problem. They missed the launch window, and they may miss another one.
Well, this was never going to be on the space shuttle. So this was all the time intended to be a launch of this. But yes, the budget overruns, I think, which are also, you know, that's always a complicated story, because if you slow down a budget, things get more and more expensive. And so just by it, it's complicated. But yes, they the fact that it's well over budget is also a problem for this.
Ira Flatto, as we get ready to wind up, I wanted to take you back to the Rogers Dry Lake Bed at Edwards Air Force Base 30 years ago. There was a moment that I know you'll never forget, a scene. All the broadcast networks were set up at one end of the dry lake bed. There were platforms that had been erected by ABC and CBS and NBC so they could construct the sets for the nightly news and their morning programs, the Today Show and that sort of thing. And there were three of these platforms, one bigger than the other. And as you went down the edge of the dry lake bed, there was the CBS and the NBC and the ABC. And then there was a card table
table.
NPR was broadcasting.
Right, we had a card table. exactly. I'll never forget that. You were there. I was there. We and General Yeager was there. And I'll never forget that. No one really knew who General Yeager was because the book, The Right Stuff, had just come out and it wasn't widely read yet. And we said we had General Yeager as our color commentator, and people had no idea who he was until the Secretary of the Air Force drove up in his car and came out and shook hands with the general. And then they finally said, oh, that's Chuck Yeager.
And that's the man who broke the sound barrier.
That's right. I will never forget that. And it was a great day for us, a great day for NPR, and it was an absolutely memorable day that I will certainly take with me forever.
It is hard to imagine. I don't think either of us could have imagined the future for the United States space program 30 years on would be what it is now. I think both of us imagined that it would be grander than it is.
I think we all said, you know, after this is over, there's got to be something. You know, this is such a new venture. This is so big. It's going to go on for so many decades. Certainly there'll be something after this. You know, there's the great quote from you mentioned the science fiction writer. What's his name?
Robert Heinlein. Yeah.
I can't think of his name at the moment. He lived in Sri Lanka. And
Arthur C. Clarke, yes.
He said when he was asked at the 25th, I think, anniversary of landing on the moon, he said, what was fantastic about, what was so amazing about landing on the moon? He said, what was fantastic is that we could go there and not go back. And I think at that time, 30 years ago, we had those ideas in our mind that this is something that's going to move forward. This is another step into space, and it's another step that will lead us to a space station and off and on, out of near-Earth orbit. And I think that was something, as you say, we had all had looked forward to, and it just has not happened.
Ira Flatow, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll let you get back to your broadcast.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Richard.
Good to talk to you.
Ira Flatow, the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation Science Friday, doing a special broadcast today, later today, from San Antonio. Richard, where are we now?
In what sense?
In the sense of where is the space shuttle Atlantis, the orbiter Atlantis?
Atlantis is now well in its way. It is on its way to the space station. It'll take a couple of days to get there, but they are now just coasting through space, experiencing the joys of weightlessness and getting out of their cumbersome survival suits, which they can stow away. They will not need them until it's time to come for reentry, but they are. You know, they had the word that the NASA commentator Rob Navius used was a flawless launch, despite that 2.5-minute delay while they worked out some fairly minor technical kink in the middle of things. But the launch went beautifully, and they are you know, sailing along and thinking about the next 12 or so days that they have to enjoy low Earth orbit.
Richard Harris, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Pleased to be here.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris with us here in the studio. Of course, stay tuned to NPR News for further coverage of the mission of the Space Shuttle Atlantis on the final flight of the American Space Shuttle. You've been listening to special coverage of the Space Shuttle launch. This is NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana. Good morning. My name is David Inge. Coming up in just a minute or so, we'll have news for you from National Public Radio. Then in the second hour of Focus Today, we'll have some more programs in this series that we are calling The Deep Archives. This year, the program turned 30, and one thing we thought we might do to mark the occasion is to rebroadcast some of the oldest interviews that we have in our tape collection. These are programs that have certainly not been heard in many years, have been stored away, and they're not part of our regular web archive. And what we've tried to do is find interesting people talking about subjects that are important, as important now as they were when we first did these shows. And the subject of the programs that you'll hear, hour number two today, art, support for the arts, and an attempt to look at the question, well, what is art? And you'll hear edited excerpts of two interviews, one with art critic and philosopher Arthur Danto. And in that program, we talked a lot about the work of Andy Warhol, one work in particular, a very famous thing called The Brillo Box. And that's the show that really looks at the question, what is art? And then in the second hour, you will hear an interview with John Frohnmayer. He was chairman of the National Endowment for the